Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our Ideas Matter segment, when we take time just about every week to check in with the state humanities councils in our seven state region. This morning, we are joined by Neil Maher, who is discussing with us a little known dimension of both the space program and the political movements of the 1960s. Neil serves as one of the New York Council for the Humanities Public Scholars. He's an associate professor in the Federated History Department of the New Jersey Institute of Technology and Rutgers University at Newark, and a public scholar for the New York Council for the Humanities. And Neil, it is very nice to have you with us this morning.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Perfectly.
Excellent. There, as you well know, there's a lot of interpretation in your last name.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is very nice to have you on the program. So how did this all come about of researching this relationship between the space race and political movements?
Well, you know, I've always been interested in the 1960s, the history of the 1960s. And as I thought about it more, I realized that that summer of July 1969, we all came together to watch the men land on the moon, but it was also 3 weeks later, the summer of Woodstock, when the country seemed incredibly divided over the Vietnam War and civil rights and many other social issues. And I began to think about that relationship between the unity of the country at that moment, but also this sort of divisive side to it, and I wanted to explore it more. And that's where this communication, this dialogue between the space race and the social and political movements of the 60s sort of came out for me.
Is this a chicken and egg thing? It's hard to know what came first.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they were dependent on each other. I mean, I think that part of the reason people felt so positive about coming together for the lunar landing was because they were experiencing so many other divisive moments in their lives in the 1960s. So I think that, you know, the feminist movement, environmentalism, civil rights, and the hippies, and the space race really fed off each other. They really actually worked well together in a way to highlight the differences that were being discussed within culture at that moment in the 60s.
When it comes to the moment where, I mean, how much of this is really because of President Kennedy and setting down an edict?
I think that it was all very much initiated because of Sputnik in 1957. The Russians launched their satellite, and both President Kennedy, but also scientists and engineers and political leaders were quite anxious about that event and were worried that we were falling behind in science and engineering. So he put down the goal of getting a man on the moon by the end of the decade. But as the 60s wore on, I think it became less about that and more about the space race and Apollo being a way of Americans feeling good about themselves during a period when there were a lot of social movements that were criticizing America for involvement in Vietnam, for racial inequality, for gender inequality. And I think that it was an interesting moment where it began maybe as a technological and scientific achievement, and it became something much more cultural, I think, as the 60s wore on.
One of the things that you explore is civil rights activists and their protests against NASA. What was the rationale behind that, and what actually were they protesting? What were they upset about?
Well, the most impressive protest was by Ralph Abernathy, who was one of Martin Luther King's most important colleagues. He marched to Kennedy Space Center on the day before the Apollo 11 launch, and he marched with four scruffy mules and a couple of old wagons and 25 poor African-American families. And he met Thomas Paine, the head of NASA, in an open field the day before the launch with the Apollo rocket off in the distance. And he claimed to Paine and also to a bunch of newspaper reporters and news cameras, he was a very savvy activist, he claimed that he wasn't protesting the Apollo launch at all. He was actually quite proud of it. But he was protesting the nation's distorted sense of priorities, that we were spending $20 billion to get men to the moon, and we weren't spending any money on, for instance, housing in America's ghettos. And they really, civil rights activists were very concerned about this issue of the urban environment and housing. We were spending all this money to house astronauts in these very expensive space capsules in space. And meanwhile, many African Americans were watching the launch in dilapidated apartments with peeling paint and no heat, no electricity. So they were very much protesting that financial priority. And it turns out that NASA was very nimble. NASA was very understanding of that critique. We have to remember that NASA was a civilian agency and had to rely on the federal government and the U.S. people for its funding. So NASA understood the critique. Thomas Paine actually understood it very well. Not only did he give Abernathy and his crew VIP passes to the launch, which was very smart, but NASA turned around and in the 70s began to enact a number of programs to try to help the urban people, African Americans in cities. They created an urban systems project office. They took technology from space capsules, heating and cooling systems from space capsules, and tried to actually implement them in low-income housing projects. So they really did try to, in a sense, engage civil rights activists. I don't think they were too successful in the end, but at least they attempted.
Because when you think about it, and the criticism is valid, it is something that many people look at today when we spend money on something that isn't for people that are desperately in need. So in that sense, why do you just, I want to explore this just a little bit further as to why NASA was not successful and what they could have done to to right that.
Sure. I mean, you know, Thomas Paine was a very smart guy as well. He said to Abernathy that day, he said, if I could not push the button to launch Apollo tomorrow and have that money go and solve the problems of the inner city, I would do that. He said, but those problems are much more complicated than just pushing a button and sending a rocket to the moon. And I think that's true. I mean, NASA tried many, many programs to attempt to correct some of the structural and built environment problems in these cities. It tried to use technologies to better the water supply system, to more efficiently produce electricity for these inner cities and these apartments and ghettos and inner cities. But much of those programs were either studies or they were technology that was very expensive to implement, and it just never really got traction. And then once we made it to the moon, the American public lost a lot of interest in space exploration anyway, and funding decreased even more. So I think that NASA's in a tough situation. Once people realized we were beating the Russians to the moon, the public lost interest, NASA began to lose funding, and then that actually siphoned money away from these other programs that were aimed at helping many of these, these social movements.
When it comes to NASA's involvement in the Vietnam War, what do we know?
Well, in the early 60s, we didn't know a lot because a lot of NASA's involvement was secret. NASA was actually helping the military with a number of programs in the war, one of which involved taking very highly sensitive seismometers that they had used on the moon to try to determine if there was any volcanic activity up there. They retooled those seismometers and dropped them along the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Vietnam to create what they called an electronic battlefield. And when communist guerrillas moved over those sensors, those hits were then radioed to a large computer in Thailand, which then radioed the coordinates to the nearest airbase and bombers that went up and began to bomb along the Ho Chi Minh Trail where those people had hit the seismometers. This became public, and all of a sudden the new left, college students all over the country, began to protest not only against the Vietnam War, but also against NASA's involvement in it. And NASA, again, being very aware that this was going to hurt its public image, halts the electronic battlefield, halts several other covert military technologies that it was developing, and redirects its satellites in ways that continue to engage the developing world, but do so without bombing the developing world. So, for instance, Landsat satellites are developed and they're deployed, and scientists and government officials from the developing world are encouraged to actually work with NASA to use these satellites to gain data about the conservation of natural resources in places like Vietnam. Vietnam actually teams up with NASA after the war to use satellite data to try to better manage its natural resources. So NASA goes from helping the military bomb Vietnam to actually helping Vietnam better assess and manage its natural resources, all for the same reason, to try to promote democracy and bring Vietnam over to our side versus, communist Russia, for instance. So very strange things going on with NASA in the middle of all of it.
when you look at this and the space race itself, you talk about how it influenced environmentalism during this period. Give us a sense of how that was the case.
Sure. I mean, I'm actually an environmental and political historian, so the environmentalism angle and the space race is really sort of what got me into this.
Right.
That, we're all familiar with that image, that photograph of the Earth from space. It's called the whole Earth image. And I was interested in exploring how NASA might have influenced the space race. And it turns out that NASA did. It provided that image, first of all. But it also NASA also provided much of the global data that scientists now use to track things like ozone depletion and climate change. But we couldn't just do it with satellites only. We also needed computer models to actually take that data and process it, and NASA's at the forefront of that as well. So NASA's influencing environmentalism, but environmentalists are also influencing the space race. The idea for that whole Earth image came from a hippie in Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco named Stuart Brand, who considered himself an environmentalist. The story is pretty incredible. He was up on his rooftop in San Francisco tripping on LSD. He saw this view of San Francisco below that he claimed he could see the curvature of the Earth, and that it really made him realize that the Earth was a finite place. And he said, we need to get that vision to the people. So he had buttons printed up that said, why haven't we seen a photograph of the whole Earth yet? He sold them at Berkeley and Stanford and Harvard and MIT, and then sent them to congressmen and administrators at NASA. And 5 years later, NASA changes the trajectory of Apollo 17, so it can capture that image of the Earth free from solar shadow. And there we have, an image that becomes an environmental icon. So there's this really interesting, interrelationship between the movement and the space race, and they're sort of engaging each other in ways that that in some ways were helpful to environmentalism and in some ways helpful to NASA.
So we've been talking about NASA and civil rights. Let's talk about NASA and women's rights. How were they in accepting women and women astronauts?
They were not good. but you have to understand that part of the early culture of NASA was a very male culture. They called it manned spaceflight for a reason. Part of the promotion of the Mercury and Gemini astronauts was that they were symbols of American manhood. They were all clean cut. They were all in good shape. They drove fast cars. And that culture was important to NASA, but NASA defended its all-male astronaut corps in other ways as well. For instance, for years, NASA claimed that the simple fact that they had not developed spacesuits for women's bodies was the reason that they would not allow women astronauts. There was also fear that travel in space might hurt female biology, which turns out to be not the case at all. As a matter of fact, in the early 1960s, there was a doctor who worked for NASA in testing the Mercury astronauts. He actually did his own test of women pilots, actually, to see if they could serve as astronauts in space, and all of them, not all of them, but many of them passed with flying colors, and some of the science actually indicated that women's bodies were better suited for outer space because they were lighter They used up less energy, and they would therefore be more efficient in getting into space. But NASA stonewalled. It wasn't until the National Organization for Women, activists like Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem, began to protest the all-male astronaut corps that NASA actually was basically forced to allow people like Sally Ride to apply and then become the first American woman in space. It turns out the Russians put up a woman, Valentina Tereshkova, in 1963, you know, a full 20 years before Sally Ride goes up. So it was a much more contentious relationship between the women's movement and NASA than it was, for example, for the environmental movement.
Neil, we are out of time, but I thank you so much for being with us this morning. Neil Mars, an associate professor in the Federated History Department of the New Jersey Institute of Technology. Neil, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Joe. It was great talking.
Always great talking to you.